I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. This week, we're looking at the hidden dangers for women working in the international humanitarian aid sector as part of our Across Women's Lives project. I'll let Marco Werman take it from here.
I've got Amy Costello back with me again. She's the Nonprofit Quarterly Senior Correspondent and Investigations Editor. Amy, what are you going to tell us about today?
Marco, we're going to talk about aid workers who make up a growing part of the industry, people of color from developing nations. They're hired locally in their own countries, and those staff are often referred to as national staff. And increasingly, these national staff are deployed to other nations, too. So you might find, say, a Zimbabwean delivering aid in Haiti or South Sudan, or someone from Ecuador working in Honduras. And when these staff begin to travel like that, they face risks, like this aid worker from the Eastern Horn of Africa region that I talked to.
When I left my country and started moving, you know, I felt like I was a lot more exposed to sexual harassment, and I often ask myself why.
So, Amy, who is this? Tell us her story.
Well, this is a veteran aid worker, and she agreed to speak to me if we would protect her identity. She's still working in the sector, and so I'm going to call her Linda. And her experience speaks to some of the unique challenges faced by many aid workers of color from developing nations. Keep in mind that this group makes up the majority of aid workers working across the globe. And when Linda is deployed to other countries, she is often working with male colleagues who also come from other parts of the world. And so each man she's working with likely has very different opinions about how women should be treated in the workplace. And here's Linda's story about how she has to navigate that.
As an African woman, you know, you struggle with a lot of things. Yes, you're coming from a highly patriarchal setting, and you're trying to, you know, overcome that. We are also most time deployed in settings which is deeply patriarchal, where men do not respect women.
In the decade that Linda has worked in humanitarian aid, she says she's been sexually harassed or assaulted in every nation she's traveled to, except for one. And a lot of that harassment happened in guest houses. Aid workers like Linda often stay in these guest houses or team houses when on assignment, which means Linda frequently sleeps under the same roof with colleagues she has never met.
I must say, sharing guest houses with people you don't know their background, it's very, very challenging for female staff and provides avenues where female workers, female humanitarian aid workers are easily exposed to sexual harassment.
For instance, Linda was working in what was considered a hardship post in East Africa for a well-known international aid group. Every few weeks, she'd get a couple of days R&R in the capital city at the organization's guest house. Linda says one time she went there and found the place empty. And then a male colleague arrived, whom she had never met.
So I greeted, we had conversation. So this staff started telling me, you know, things inappropriate, how he liked me, even touched me. And I told him, you know, I don't think I like what you're doing. I cannot just touch someone like that or tell someone something inappropriate. So anyway, he stopped that. We shifted to other conversation. But what shocked me is that when I went to my room, I discovered that I could not lock the room while I'm sleeping. If I can remember, that was the longest night I ever had because I was so scared. I was imagining, what if this guy walks into my room and rapes me?
He didn't. The guy left the next morning on another assignment. But Linda says if she had been raped that night, she doesn't think anyone would have believed her. And she doubts that she would get the same kind of support that a Western colleague would receive.
I think in general terms, yes, black women who report the case are not handled in the same way as a white woman.
She gives an example of how she and some African colleagues responded after one of their American colleagues was sexually assaulted and subsequently evacuated by helicopter, or chopper, as Linda calls it.
The action that was taken by my organization at that time, obviously, it raised a lot of questions. And so many people were talking, like even black women said, okay, if this was a black woman, could the organization had hired a chopper, you know, this doctor to go and pick this person from there? Could the organization had given her 3 months break with full pay? Yeah. And could the organization have provided her a provisions to come back or to get to be reassigned in another position? So these are privileges that as black women, I think we do not have.
Another thing they may not have is equal compensation. Many Black African aid workers don't get the pay their white colleagues receive, nor the same perks like accommodation allowances and maybe access to vehicles on weekends. A 2009 study by the University of New Zealand found that pay disparities in the aid sector created among local staff, quote, significant feelings of workplace injustice. They felt less valued than their expatriate colleagues. Linda tells me that even though she's been harassed on the job many times, she's never filed a complaint. She doesn't see the point.
There wouldn't be sufficient action taken. And if action is taken, either they will say there's no facts or evidence to substantiate the claim. And then there you are, you know. Because I have seen it happen. I have seen it happen to many staff. There was one when I was a national staff. The thing was investigated. The lady became an outcast in the organization. And yes, I've not really gone steps to report because basically you don't expect anything to be done about it.
Back in the studio with Amy Costello, I mean, that is pretty damning, Amy, coming from somebody who works in the sector. What have aid organizations themselves said about these allegations of different treatment for national staff and for international staff?
Well, you know, it needs to be said that people who start off as national staff certainly can and do kind of work their way up the ladder and get, you know, nice pay and perks. But proponents of this kind of dual pay system will argue that international staff have higher costs of living, you know, back home, and that aid groups need to offer them competitive salaries. And they also want to avoid, you know, skewing the pay scales of local economies when lots of aid groups come in and flood a crisis zone and they pay the locals what they're paying, say, international staff. That could really adversely impact local organizations who are simply trying to pay local staff a going rate. But it's this general sense of unequal treatment on the part of national staff that may impact the sense of agency that they feel and whether they're going to report sexual abuse when it happens. And my producer, Freddie Boswell, and I, we wanted to hear from more national staff about their experiences with sexual assault and harassment. And we had a very hard time finding anyone who would speak to us.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think right now there is a certain level of frustration among aid workers about the pace of change in the sector as it relates to abuse and harassment. And we'll discuss some of that tomorrow. But one aid worker I talked to who has shared her story in the media about her assault at the hands of a colleague, she told me that she really has been struggling lately since going public. She feels nothing has really changed since she told her story. She then received an email from her employer after her case was profiled in the media, which brought back a lot of flood of emotions for her. So there can be a high cost for going public. And another reason we may not hear from local aid workers about sexual abuse is because they have so much riding on these jobs. You know, they're highly prized in these countries. Mm-hmm. They are often supporting extended family with their jobs, so they have so much to lose. But there was another worker we did find. Her name is Leslie Agams, and she said she would speak to me. She's a Nigerian and says national staff suffer from a lot of abuse.
Women in Africa who are working for international development, they need a whole lot more protection. The stories I heard before I became a victim, some of them were horrendous.
Agams used to work for a well-known international aid group in Nigeria, and she says she was sexually assaulted by her boss, but the organization could not find sufficient evidence to substantiate her claim. So we're not going to get into the particulars of her case, but we wanted to get Agams' take on sexual harassment and abuse in the sector more broadly. And she and Linda, who we heard from earlier, both agree that many aid workers face it regardless of race or where they're from.
There was at least one victim who was an American. She was an intern, and she was brutally, from what I heard, raped by an American expatriate. They were in Congo. Her abuser took advantage of the fact that they were in Africa, where the laws and the rules are more, what word would I use?
Less enforceable.
Yes, exactly. You know, the judicial system is more vulnerable to influences, especially the influence of money. And they do things that they would not dare try in Europe or in the U.S.
So, Amy, quick question. Do these cases fall into some sort of legal limbo because you've got foreign organizations based in the U.S. or the U.K., different sets of laws from the countries these aid workers are assigned to? How does that all work out?
Yeah, it's all incredibly complicated. And this seems to be another reason why many aid workers who are victims of sexual assault don't report. We spoke to Christine Williamson. She's the founder and director of Duty of Care International, and she helps aid groups put policies and systems in place so that workers are safe in humanitarian settings. And she says when victims want to report assault that happens in the midst of a humanitarian crisis or in a conflict zone, there's basically one way to do it.
I think it'll depend on who and where and when. But on the whole, I would say it depends on the law of the land whether or not you report this to the police. I would say 9 times out of 10, you're supposed to report it to the police.
And I can imagine, though, I mean, anybody would likely imagine how difficult and perhaps even improbable that would be, you know, in a conflict zone or with a, you know, corrupt government, or there's rebel forces around, or who knows what, a food crisis, a famine. I mean, the idea that somebody would actually go to local police to report this just seems unlikely to me.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, they probably won't want to. In fact, the last thing they'd probably want to do is report it to the local police, where the justice system isn't known or trusted, where there may be a culture of stigmatization. The whole thought of reliving a traumatic act in a foreign environment, maybe even in a different language. I would imagine it's just the last thing that anyone would want to do. And I have known cases where it hasn't been reported for that reason.
So, Amy, tell us what aid organizations can do to support victims of sexual abuse and harassment and protect their staff before something actually happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things in order to make women and men feel safe doing this work is to have processes in place that employees trust and that they know what will happen if they do report, that they will be taken care of and provided for by their organization, that they will not be singled out. And those are some of the things that we'll hear about tomorrow. And here's Heidi Lehman, an aid worker, talking about what she would like to see happen.
From an aid worker being raped in South Sudan to sexual harassment happening in Haiti, I want to see senior management go through scenario-based training so they know what to do.
Tomorrow, Amy Costello will be bringing us more voices from the international aid community when our series wraps up. It's in partnership with Nonprofit Quarterly. And speaking of tomorrow, be sure to join us for a Facebook Live at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Amy will be hosting a panel on the Me Too movement in the aid sector. You'll find that at our Across Women's Lives Facebook page. Or if you're in the Boston area, you can check it out in person. That's at 4 p.m. at the Boston Public Library.